Ray Dalio made the same point. He talked about how money really isn't the way that we gauge wealth, that our assets are, the things that we can own. He wrote in his latest book, A Changing World Order, not only about that concept, but he also talked about his belief that for a variety of different reasons, I know that he used eight factors, that the United States was in decline and that China was going to pass us up. I saw a video that you did with Ray the other day. You did a wonderful job in it, but what I was really impressed by was that you were much more optimistic about the future of the United States. And I'd like to know more about why.
You know, I think there's a fundamental test for any country. And it's the single best way of making judgments about countries' medium-term prospects. And that is to ask, where does capital want to go? And where do talented people want to go? And if you look right now, talented people are coming to America. They're desperate to come to America. They're pounding against our immigration laws. If you look at what's happened to the value of the dollar, capital is flowing into America. If you look at China, people want to leave. Some ways, sometimes they even have to restrict people from leaving the country. And capital is trying to get out of the country at a very rapid rate. And so you take all that together, and I think it gives you a reason for optimism about the future of the United States.
Paul Johnson, I'm with the Optimistic American, and I'm here with Larry Summers. Larry was Treasury Secretary as well as the President of Harvard. He has done some amazing things. My own staff calls him a very big deal, but I remember speaking to Bill Clinton some time ago when he was president. He said that when Larry's in a room, he's literally the smartest guy in the room by double. I've been very impressed in being able to listen to him and to gain insights from him. But Larry, thank you for being on our show.
It's really a privilege to be here with you. Thank you.
I want to start with this. I listened to you. You came in front of one of our groups about 9 months ago, and you made this prediction on inflation, and everybody seemed to be disagreeing with you. It was almost uncanny. What did you see then that other people just didn't seem to see?
I did a relatively simple calculation. It looked to me like we were 2 or 3% short of the potential of the economy in terms of production. And I saw that we were about to inject 12% of GDP into the economy. I saw that there was a $2 trillion overhang of savings from 2020 when people couldn't take vacations or go to restaurants. I saw that interest rates were zero. And I saw that the Fed was buying bonds faster than any central bank in the history of the world had ever bought bonds. And I thought, if you're putting your foot that hard down on the accelerator and you're shifting into that high a gear, your car's gonna get going awfully fast and probably not stay completely in control. And that was what I predicted. And that I predicted that slowing the car down was going to be really quite difficult under the circumstances. And I think those predictions are looking, unfortunately, to have been right. I thought that it is just altogether too easy after a period of 40 years when inflation was basically very, very stable to conclude that nothing caused rising inflation, because we hadn't had any rising inflation, so nothing had caused rising inflation for 40 years. And so I thought the intellectual consensus was going wrong a bit. And so I had a history, Paul, where people had been worried about inflation at a number of different junctures, and I had mostly dismissed the worries. So I looked at myself and I said, your instinct is not to be an inflation alarmist. It's, if anything, to be a recession alarmist. And so when I saw that, I thought the right thing to do was to add to the debate by speaking pretty vigorously about inflation concerns.
And what do you think we have to be careful of with long-term inflation? Why should Americans be concerned about that?
You know, historically, when wage inflation gets above about 4%, real wages, the purchasing power of workers' wages, actually starts to go down. So when you have higher inflation, the economy works less well, you tend to have less productivity, and that tends to lead to slower real wage growth. When you have more inflation, people tend to be angry and surly. Some of it is irrational, that they think that the high wages are something they earned and the high prices are something that's being taken from them, rather than recognizing that they're both consequences of an inflation process. But it tends to go with a pretty surly and angry kind of population. That's the second thing. A third reason to be concerned about inflation is that it encourages a diversion of resources into the financial activity. If I hold up on paying you, or you collect more rapidly from me, that doesn't matter in a world of low inflation. But with a high inflation, I'm saving a bunch by delaying paying you, and you're saving a bunch by collecting more quickly from me. So we all do a lot of things and we fight each other to a draw, trying to win that zero-sum game. So my sense is that inflation is actually a pretty costly kind of phenomenon. And certainly we live in a democracy, and it's extremely clear that at present, as in the past, people are very alarmed and negative on inflation.
So in our interviews with Larry Summers, you're going to see a number of different segments. We had a limited time with Larry, so I'm going to take some time to put in some additional commentary. Larry Summers was literally one of the few people who projected that high inflation would be taking place. And he gave a great description a moment ago about why that was. If you look at the generation who's alive today, there have really been two inflationary periods. That happened between the 1950s and the 1960s, that was caused because of industry. And then the other that happened between the 1970s and 1992, when the baby boomers came of age and they started buying product. Well, when they were buying product, that created an inflationary period. Well, what happened after 1992? After 1992, a couple of things took place. First, the baby boomers were no longer in those buying years, and there was a lag between them and the next set of buyers, which became the millennials. The millennials are now entering into an era where they are buying a lot of product. But between 1992 and the current day, millennials weren't buying. The Russians, while the Soviet Union collapsed, they had a huge amount of commodities that they kept putting out onto the marketplace. And the Chinese were increasing the amount of laborers that were available in the world by becoming a part of the world market. That created a period of low inflation. Well, what's happening today? Millennials are buying. The Chinese workforce is starting to go away. And because of the war, the Russians are no longer adding commodities to the table. We believe we're going to see a doubling of industrial output done right here in the United States. Now, we're probably going to see inflation for the next 3 to 5 years based upon some economists that I'm listening to. But it doesn't have to be a jobless inflationary period of time. In fact, it might end up being quite the opposite, where we have a significant amount of jobs where we're trying to keep up on the supply side. And clearly today, I think that's going to benefit millennials and new workers. We're going to be in a position where they're going to be highly sought after for jobs. So what I noticed, Ray Dalio made the same point. He talked about how money really isn't the way that we gauge wealth. that our assets are, the things that we can own. He wrote in his latest book, A Changing World Order, not only about that concept, but he also talked about his belief that for a variety of different reasons, I know that he used eight factors, that the United States was in decline and that China was going to pass us up. I saw a video that you did with Ray the other day. You did a wonderful job in it. But what I was really impressed by was that you were much more optimistic about the future of the United States. And I'd like to know more about why.
You know, I think there's a fundamental test for any country. And it's the single best way of making judgments about countries' medium-term prospects. And that is to ask, where does capital want to go? And where do talented people want to go? And if you look right now, talented people are coming to America. They're desperate to come to America. They're pounding against our immigration laws. If you look at what's happened to the value of the dollar, capital is flowing into America. If you look at China, people want to leave. Some ways, sometimes they even have to restrict people from leaving the country. And capital is trying to get out of the country at a very rapid rate. And so you take all that together, and I think it gives you a reason for optimism about the future of the United States. And look, God knows we have our problems with polarization, lack of confidence in government institutions, and so many other things. On the other hand, we are the only country in the world where you can raise your first $100 million before you buy your first suit. And in an entrepreneurial age, that's a profoundly important thing. We are the place that has the universities that generate a pretty high fraction of the world's ideas and that people want to come to from all over the world. We are the place where the vaccines were developed. We are the place where much of the clean energy technology has been developed. We are the place where much of the world's culture is shaped by our music, by our art, by our television shows, even by our video games. And so I think it's a mistake to discount a nation which is both pervasive in its impact globally and a nation which is dynamic and seems to have a capacity to reinvent itself. Paul, you know, I think that one of the great American secrets is our capacity for self-denying prophecy. Americans all the time are forecasting doom, whether it was Jimmy Carter with the malaise speech, people talking about how the Cold War was over and Japan had won, whether it was the idea that FDR would have to assume dictatorial powers to combat the Depression, whether it was the idea of the missile gap, whether it was Patrick Henry in 1792 saying that the spirit of the American Revolution had already been lost. All of these things have something in common. People predict doom, people predict disaster, and precisely because of those predictions, forces are set in motion that lead to repair. And I think that's been the case in America in the past, and I believe it will be again.
Yeah, what I liked about Dalio's book is that he gave two recommendations that just to me were common sense. We have to make more than we spend, and we have to be nice to one another. And I thought both of those recommendations were solid.
Both of them have considerable merit, absolutely.
Secretary Summers did an outstanding job in telling us why it was that China wasn't going to beat the United States. And again, while I really love Ray Dalio's work, I completely disagree with his assumption in his last book that we were going to be overtaken by China. If you look at the video that we have on our podcast with Michael Beckley, he wrote a book called Unrivaled. It is a book that I highly recommend, and it puts a lot of meat on what Larry was saying. Larry is very good at summarizing very, very complex subjects. But the United States versus China, we have a variety of different advantages. First, geographically, we are in much better position. The United States, as Professor Beckley pointed out, is an economic fortress, and China is surrounded by adversaries. Japan, Taiwan, Korea, Vietnam, even Russia, they've had a number of different border disputes with. They spend about half of their money, half of their defense budget is spent on securing their borders. And while they're an army that's about twice as big as ours, they are also still one that's not nearly as efficient. If you look at demographics, they're in big trouble. They have because of the one-child policy, they have a much smaller base of people now who are going to have to support a large group of people who are retiring. It's an inverted pyramid. The United States is the exact opposite. We should be very thankful for the millennials because they replace the boomers, and they're going to be the ones that are paying for those retirement benefits over the upcoming years. Institutionally, we're in much better shape than China. Not a little better, but dramatically better. And then if you look at the efficiency of China versus the United States, China, 1 in 3 workers in China works on food production, on creating food, and they are the largest importer of food in the world. The United States, less than 1% of our workers work in food production, and we're one of the largest exporting nations in the history of the planet. And when it comes to currency, the yuan is not even going to come close to replacing the American dollar as part of our reserve currency. Larry did a good enough job of explaining why that was true. All right, so you were Secretary of Treasury. Your predecessor, Alexander Hamilton, once took on the issue of making certain that the United States repays its debts. And the point that you were just making about where capital flows, it seems to me that that all the way from the very beginning of this country, making certain that we pay our debts, that we're not devaluing our dollar, which obviously China and others do devalue their currency to try to help their exports, and that we also have property rights, are all three important issues that help keep capital and people flowing in the right direction.
Well, I would agree with that. I think no nation can devalue its way to prosperity. Mm-hmm. And I think ultimately we do want to have a strong currency based on strong fundamentals. And I think that's something that is very much within our reach. I would also say to you, and this is kind of a wisecrack, but it captures the truth, that in some ways at this moment, the dollar is fortunate in its alternatives. Europe is a museum. Japan is a nursing home. China is a jail. And Bitcoin is an experiment. Uh-huh. And so even if people see the dollar as having its problems, if you sell dollars, you have to buy something. And it's not clear what people will want to buy.
All right. Most Americans really don't know what the Treasury Secretary does. You held that job. Can you give people an understanding of what you actually did while you were in that job and why it's an important role in the United States?
Treasury Secretary is the president's premier economic and financial official, responsible for guiding the president on everything that has to do with finance. The Treasury Department administers the nation's tax system. It has substantial responsibility along with the Federal Reserve for the financial stability of the nation's banking and broader financial system. It coordinates the country's international financial financial relations, and it is responsible for maintaining the right sets of deterrence against financial crime. money laundering and so forth, administering sanctions where those things are necessary. So there's plenty of things that happen that keep a treasury secretary pretty busy.
What was the big crisis during your era? I know everyone has one. What was yours, and how did you work your way through it?
Probably the two biggest crises that happened during my time at the Treasury were the Mexican financial crisis in 1995 and the Asian financial crisis that rolled through Asia in 1998 and 1999. And our approach was to think that it was very important to add confidence to the situation by ourselves, and even more through the IMF, functioning as a kind of lender of last resort and being prepared to commit funds so that people would be confident and you wouldn't have bank runs all over the place. But to only do that with insistence on self-help, that countries repaired their economies so that this wouldn't happen. Again, as I look, Mexico, up until the time we were there, had had a financial crisis every 6 years to coincide with its presidential elections. And it's now been 25 years since the last Mexican financial crisis. I think that not everything is perfect, but you can look at the economic progress that South Korea has made, or that Thailand has made, or that Indonesia has made. And I think we can take satisfaction from the ways in which we controlled a situation that was potentially uncontrollable at that time.
So what do you think the United States has to do short-term and long-term to maintain its global position?
It's a combination of things. I think we need to be more rigorous about our money. Fed's gonna need to raise rates. The Fed's gonna need to print less money. We're gonna need to make sure that if we're spending money and borrowing money, we're doing it in order to invest, not to consume. We've got huge needs to strengthen our education system, huge needs to make government function. I mean, if you look at the IRS, for example, nobody likes paying taxes, but for the system to work, everybody has to pay taxes. And its enforcement budget has been cut in half over the last 10 years, even as the amount of tax enforcement that's necessary has gone way up. So we need to make necessary public investments. Education's a fundamental part of that. I think we need to signal that while we've got a lot of problems at home, the United States is gonna continue to look globally and continue to try to provide leadership on global problems. That means we've got to come up with funds, which we have not done this year, to support the international COVID assistance programs. That means we have to figure out how to be part of the process of resolving global climate change. Those are some of the things I would emphasize.
Do you believe that that in the inequities in the United States are a problem? And if you do, what do you think that we need to do to try to help reduce them?
I think poverty is a problem in the United States. I think lack of opportunity for many kids is a problem. I think kids shouldn't be going to school in classes of 40 third graders. I think kids should be able to go to schools where conditions are decent enough that you don't need policemen to guard the halls. If we need to compensate our teachers in ways that reflect that teaching is a valued and honored profession, so that every kid feels that they have an opportunity. But unlike some of my friends, I really reject the politics of envy. I don't think the goal should be to tear down billionaires. I think the goal should be to create more opportunities for more people to make their fortunes.
Hear, hear.
Should taxes be based more on ability to pay than perhaps they are right now? Yeah. Do I think that some people's taxes are probably lower and they're more able to use loopholes than they should be? Absolutely. There are a variety of schemes that people use that avoid taxes that I think we ought to be closing up. But if we tax people really based on the ability to pay for things we all need, and we seek to include everybody in our prosperity, I think that's a much better way of going at it than stoking up resentment to those who are most fortunate, often who are those who have been drivers in producing fantastic benefits for the whole society, as for example, Amazon has brought enormous benefits to the whole economy. So do I begrudge its founders and leaders their success? No. Should it be taxed more fully and properly? Yes. But I think if we can get away from the politics of envy to the politics of opportunity and fairness in taxation based on ability to pay, I think we can do better on some of these divisive issues.
All right. So education, you keep, it seems to be a point in terms of how we deal with inequities. You went on to become the president of Harvard. What made you make that decision to leave the Treasury Secretary job? You could have gone and done almost anything, and I'm sure many of them would have been a lot more lucrative. And you decided instead to go be the head of one of the major universities in the United States. What made you make
that decision? Just to be clear, there's a reason why I stopped being Treasury Secretary, which is that Bill Clinton left office and George W. Bush became president, and there wasn't going to be a Democrat Treasury Secretary under George W. Bush. So I went from being Treasury Secretary of the United States to being unemployed.
My guess is you had a lot of options.
I decided that, you know, I began my career, and now after the various things I've done, I'm back in a role as a professor of economics. And I guess the reason I do that, Paul, is I think the two most important things for the future of the world are the next generation who are going to lead the world, who are going to be bequeathed the world, and how they're formed and how they're influenced. And a set of new ideas and new understandings, whether it's of what constitutes fairness, or how to cure cancer, whether it's conceptions of beauty and understanding of other cultures, or whether it's how to put a man on Mars. I think that it's ideas that ultimately drive the world. And so what are the communities in our country that have the greatest responsibility for bringing forth young people and creating ideas? Those communities are universities. And that's why I was so proud to be asked to lead perhaps our greatest university. And that's why I find it so exciting to be in a university environment today. You know, if you saw the set of students who are flowing in and out of my office, working on various research projects, looking for advice on their future careers, what have you. No one could be a fly on the wall in my office and see these remarkable young people and be pessimistic about the future of our country.
All right. So what advice, especially after we talked about the short-term challenges that we may face, what advice would you give an American family who might be struggling to play financial defense in terms of what they should do to prepare themselves for the next year or 2 years, understanding what may be coming?
So, you know, I give everybody one piece of advice I give everybody is that in a world where there's more and more specialization, in a world where there's more and more division of labor, success in life depends more than ever on building on your strengths rather than on remedying your weaknesses. So I tell people to figure out what their strength is, what their distinctive ability to contribute is, what their passion is and to build on that. And if people do that, I think there's enormous opportunity ahead. For the next year or two, I'd batten down the hatches a bit. If you're borrowing money, I'd borrow it for the longer term rather than the shorter term. So you'll have it on hand. I wouldn't make plans that were overly rigid, because I think we may find ourselves in a period of substantial volatility. I'd be careful of postponing any kind of purchase in the anticipation that it will get cheaper in the future, because I think it's more likely to get more expensive in the future. Those would be some of my thoughts.
Yeah, it's a lot along the lines of Warren Buffett, who I think said the greatest hedge for inflation is be exceptional at what you do. So on this last issue, what should you do for your family, especially if you're an entrepreneur or you're in business? Here's my strongest advice to you. Economies go up, and as sure as they do, they come back down. When they come down, as sure as they do, they'll go back up. Over time, there's an arc where it ends up being better this year, certainly, than it was 10 years and 20 years and 50 years ago. But you've got to get through those down cycles, and they're going to happen. If you're an entrepreneur, I strongly recommend that you always be prepared for a down cycle. You need oxygen to be able to get through those valleys. And that means not taking your highest peak of income and going out and buying as many things as you possibly can on credit. That means saving some money and putting some money away for a rainy day. And if you have that excess supply, if you have the oxygen to get through a bad market, then as an entrepreneur, you're going to flourish in those times when it begins to take off again. All right, so my last question for you is, what advice do you have for Americans, many of whom are really terrified about what they hear on the nightly news, what they're seeing on their social marketing? They're being bombarded with this message about the United States falling into a position where it's inferior to China, where their children may not do as well as they do. They're afraid of just so many things. It really has become quite the era of alarmist on almost everything. You can get a book that will tell you about why you should be alarmed about anything in America. What advice would you give them?
Take a deep breath. Look outside. The sun is probably shining. And it's easy to see problems if you look day to day. But if you can step back, the world makes enormous progress. Life expectancy has gone up by about 5 hours every day in the United States since 1960. The conditions in which poverty families live today are better than the conditions in which middle-class families lived when I was a kid. Poverty families today are more likely to have two cars, more likely to have air conditioning, more likely for each child to have a separate bedroom than was the case for poverty-stricken families, for middle-class families when I went to school. We've got enormous problems of social justice, but we are a more tolerant society, a more integrated society, a more accepting society than at any point in the history of our republic. So I would say, take a deep breath, look back a substantial distance and look forward until now. And there's a lot that's positive going on in this country.
Yeah, I think there's no doubt. The best proof you need to be optimistic about the future is just by looking back and recognizing how far we've come and how much we've done.
And absolutely,
it's the job of the nightly media. They sell ads by telling you how bad it's going to be. Politicians need to try to isolate you into different corners. But the reality is that the world is a lot better place than oftentimes we think. And sometimes it's just by going out for a run that you figure that out.
Well, it can be made better, though.
It can
and
be
that's
made
all
better.
Of our obligation.
Yeah, yeah, and I
this generation of Americans is as fortunate as any group of people ever have been, and we've got an obligation to keep that trend going up and to the right.
Yeah, I thought your point earlier with Ray Dalio, the idea that sometimes we alarm people is also designed to try to make certain that we get better. That happens in a democracy. The opposite of it is that in autocracies, they aren't warned. They're only told about the good things that are happening. So it's okay that we're being warned. We just need to keep it in perspective.
Absolutely.
Well, Larry, thank you so much. We appreciate you giving us time.
Thank you.
Hopefully you'll enjoy where you are today. The weather is getting a little hot here. I hope that it's okay back there.
Great to be with you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Larry.
Bye-bye.